Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats, though they weren't obsolete when we started. You can also think of this podcast as one where we review films from the VHS era, though not necessarily on VHS. And if you listen very carefully to the intro sounds to the podcast, you know it's a different machine we're listening to, playing today. Yes, so our film for this episode is Humanoids from the Deep, also known as Monster, from 1980. And we have it on Laserdisc. This was the film we were going to review for episode 36.
Right.
And then I learned that I knew how to repair Laserdisc players. And now we watched a Laserdisc, most of it anyway. Getting it from Pleasant Dreams Movies and Records in lovely, beautiful Polish Hill, Pittsburgh. Yeah.
But still problematic because Laserdiscs are just giant CDs. And as you know, if you get a scratch on a CD.
Or a fingerprint.
On a fingerprint, you're
in trouble. Or whatever.
So the last couple minutes we were.
Last 2 minutes we had to stream. We had to sell out stream. I mean, trust me, I tried everything. I even washed part of the Laserdisc in the kitchen sink.
Yes, nothing.
And for some reason, the last 2 minutes just went fat, mega fast forward. There was a scratch in it, basically.
Yeah.
But that's okay. And we did get to see the shocking final scene, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But, you know, these things, they're temperamental. They're complicated machines. And
so I think, like, the most important thing we have to mention is that the lead character, Doug McClure, is the actor Doug McClure, is the inspiration for Troy McClure on The Simpsons. And that might be my favorite factoid for this whole movie.
There's a lot interesting about this film. It is a Roger Corman film, figuring it is, you know, 2 days before Halloween. Like, we couldn't do Halloween season without a Roger Corman film.
Right, because
maybe the spooky season is Roger Corman season. This also stars Vic Morrow 2 years before he was killed on the set of Twilight Zone the movie. There's this bizarre... Well, not bizarre. I mean, it is a weird movie. There's IDF's Eco-Horror. There's problems with biotechnology. There's also kind of ideas about big business and neoliberalism in 1980, which is fascinating. But I think first, maybe we should probably summarize the plot real quick. Imagine, folks, Creature from the Black Lagoon. But what if there were creatures?
Which is exactly how this movie feels like it was pitched. Like, you know that creature from the Black Lagoon?
What if we had, like, a bunch of them? And they, like, both, like, killed people, but also wanted to impregnate people. The creatures, the humanoids from the deep.
Which, you know, Creature from Black Lagoon did hint that he was trying to...
That he was...
Yeah.
And so, which is one of the things about this film, and we'll talk about
it's
this
It's also
probably.
A more, like, randier version of The Shape of Water.
Yes, it is. It is a less kind and gentle Shape of Water. Which is, I mean, part of what makes the film bizarre it's not consensual.
Right.
The sea creatures are out there to impregnate humans and...
Right.
And in a way, it's kind of weird. And it is a Roger Corman film. It is an exploitation film.
Yeah.
Some of it seemed like there was just like, well, we have to get boobs in this movie.
Yeah.
And so that's the other thing that's kind of strange about it.
The film was directed by a female film director, which it was huge for that time. Not that there's a ton more female directors now.
Yeah. Who herself had a film career... before this as like second unit director on films like Candy Stripe Girls and which is it's called Candy Stripe Girls, folks.
Right.
Yeah, and this was before the internet, so you had to
see it on
the screen before you could see it in your home.
So it was interesting because it was a female director and she I guess in the initial cut it was more hinted at what the humanoids were doing, where there was scenes that she did not direct that were added to the film that were much more graphic and had a lot more nudity and things like that.
Which is also fascinating. So the laser discs that we have that you can see the picture of, if you follow us on Instagram, is part of the Roger Corman Classics series.
Mm.
You know, describes from the man who introduced us to Jack Nicholson, Francis Ford Coppola, and a bunch of other people. And so there's an interview. The first two chapters of the film, of the Laserdisc, is an interview between Leonard Maltin and Roger Corman. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating you say that, because one of the things that struck me to the point where I wrote it down in my notebook so we could talk about it was he said, you know, part of his philosophy of horror, one of his rules, maybe the number one rule, is you're playing with people's psychology. You can't show the creature. If it's a creature film, you can't show the creature in the first half of the film.
Right.
Which I think is fascinating, which I looked at the clock, 79-minute film, at minute 34.
You see the creature in full. You get hints of a creature.
You get a hand, you get a claw.
You get a footprint.
A footprint.
But you don't see the creature until...
You don't get a guy in a rubber suit.
Right.
Until 34 minutes in. But then, yeah. And he said, you know, because considering the budget I have, there's no way I can make anything more terrifying than what people imagine themselves. Mm. So that's fascinating to say he does that in the first part of the film, and then probably definitely had a hand in, or the expectation to add more... at the end of the film, you know, I mean, more breasts. I mean, there's a scene where, so there's a bunch of dogs get killed. The first kill is a kid, you know. I mean,
right, which is shocking because a kid gets killed first.
But then the parents don't really grieve, or the dad doesn't have to grieve because he gets blown up. Then a bunch of dogs get killed.
Yeah,
which you don't kill the dogs either, but there's like a dog massacre, and then
right.
Subplot, they think the Native American did it, so they kill his dog, and there's a scene with more dead dogs.
Yeah.
Which is odd. And then they realize that...
Well, actually, it's smart if you think about it, because if they're coming in the night, there's nothing to warn people that something is coming. So if you take out the dogs, there's not going to be barking.
Yeah, but there's a lot of dead dogs in this movie.
This is true. This is true.
Which is weird.
Which we have dogs, so that we do not feel comfortable with.
Which you can usually hear roaming around in the podcast.
if you listen carefully to other ones, you'll know.
Which you haven't made noise yet. We're 7 minutes in. And we haven't even got through the whole plot summary yet. So basically the rising action is the sea creatures get bolder. They take out campers, skinny dippers, people just making out on the beach.
Yeah.
To the point where they finally attack the town fair. They have a big festival. And by this point, though, the festival people are missing. And they're like, well, let's have the festival anyway. Out on the pier, on the edge of the water. And so then the final battle with the sea creatures. And then there's this shocking final scene that is Alien.
Yes, it's definitely an Alien ripoff.
With a dip through Halloween.
Yes.
There's a dip through how last two scenes, this is creatures from the Black Lagoon.
Right.
And then there's a scene that's Halloween.
Right. Well, don't forget, the beginning is Jaws.
Yes, so you're right. It's Jaws for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Creatures from the Black Lagoon for 70 minutes. 5 minutes of Halloween. And then there's a one scene, one shot, 1 minute of Aliens.
Yes. Yep.
So. And that's the film. It did come out in 1980, so it could be derivative of many things.
Thanks.
Especially, though, Jaws.
Yes.
Jaws. And, you know, it even borrows from Orca.
Yeah.
So you think it is one of those, like, Jaws follow-ups, like Piranha and Orca, to the point where it actually borrows, not just from Jaws, but it borrows something from Orca, which we should do on this podcast at some point.
And that's it in a nutshell. So it's
in a nutshell.
You forgot to mention, though, that a scientist has been experimenting with making salmon reproduce quicker and their life cycle quicker, and they think that the humanoids, the reason why they're there is because of this exposure to this.
They ate the salmon, got the hormones, got the juice.
Yeah.
So there is also then this question of biotechnology. Right. There's also this tension of this working, and again, it's the end of 70s stagflation, this working class fishing community and the big business wants to swoop in and open a fish cannery, and basically there's this tension that all of the fish are going to then go to big business, and all these independent family businesses are going to go away, and so there's also this incredible tension in the community about, you know, who's going to get to be prosperous in this new economic order.
Right.
And not, which is, again, the way that this movie is, like, stupid smart.
Well, and also, like, they also throw in Johnny Eagle as representing his community, Native American
community. So there's also issues of settler colonialism.
But also, like, as you mentioned, I believe you mentioned, like, they actually had an agreement to certain rights around water rights and things like that. And more water rights being violated. So that's actually interesting, too. Like, they kind of... So there was, like, the writer of the screenplay and, you know, the director, like, you could tell that they were trying to make some interesting points with this film.
Yes.
I don't know if...
But also is a very low-budget Roger... I mean, it's peak Roger Corman, maybe? Or maybe close to the peak of Roger Corman?
Yeah.
Guys in Rubber Suits, TNA, Blood, the guy who inspired Troy McClure. Yeah.
Right, which is all important. Yeah, so I think, you know, in the time, if you look at it, and so, you know, I did a lazy Google search for it. It's not listed as a eco horror film, right?
But it clearly is.
But it clearly is. And so there's this film, not Our Prophecy, not the prophecy from the 90s, but the prophecy from 1979, that I saw it way, way, way too young, late at night, and it terrified me. And it really, to this day, this movie will randomly pop in my head. I haven't rewatched it, because I'm like, what if it's, lame? But it's called The Prophecy, and it's about... Mercury getting into water in a logging community, it mutates a bear, and that bear goes crazy and is killing people.
Mm.
And so that was like that kind of eco-terrorism has kind of always...
Eco-horror.
It's the eco part of it terrorized me. I've always kind of had a little space in my heart for eco-horror because of that particular film.
Yeah.
So as we're watching it, I said, oh, this is actually a pretty effective... Eco-horror,
and in an odd way, it predicts post-humanism, which is something critical theory caught up with, you know, a decade or, well, 2 decades later, this idea of, you know, how does technology change, or our understanding of evolution change the way we think about the human as a special category of life, thus post-humanism, and especially if we can either create the singularity that's smarter than us, but also awareness that other creatures have intelligence like us and we're not so special.
Mm-hmm.
Humanoids.
And actually the scientist does point out, like, they have very large brains, which is kind of fascinating. It's like very evident they have very large brains. And she says, I don't think they're fully using their brains, which gives a hint that as, like, they evolve more,
they were evolving quite rapidly,
where they become more intelligent. And the reason why I bring up the dogs is, like, if you give credence to the thought that they're intelligent, they would have thought, oh, those dogs are going to make noise at nighttime.
They bark, yeah.
They bark. And then, you know, even just kind of, like, attacking the fair, right? You know, it's kind of, like, in the midst of everyone freaking out, how easy would it be to pick off women?
Yes.
In the midst of it all. Which, especially if they were quickly wanting to reproduce, what a better way to get a large number of women at once with attacking here. And in their mind, no one would have really known that they existed at that point.
Yes.
With it. So it is...
everybody who saw them die.
Everyone who saw them died or was attacked and was raped and impregnated.
Yes.
So it's kind of fascinating that it plays with that thought that they could become rapidly smarter than humans.
Yes.
Now, the premise that it's that large prehistoric fish that everyone knows still lives and exists, that it was that fish that evolved into a humanoid. That kind of, that's the science around that is a little
the science sketchy. Is totally sketchy. But again, you think about our contemporary interest in cryptids.
Yeah, this is true.
Which, this is, you know, true. Is practically becoming a state, one of the leading state industries in West Virginia is cryptids. Because, you know, what else does any of us have? Is also fascinating.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. Yeah, this is true. Yeah. Where do you want to go from here?
Where can we go from here? Well, I guess...
Do you want to jump into the question? I have actually a couple things, but I feel like they are more related to the questions.
So we should just jump into the questions then?
Yeah, let's jump into the questions.
All right. Is it camp, retro classic, or just an old movie?
It's campy. Like, for me, it's very absolute camp. Campy. Yeah.
We haven't had a camp film in a while.
Yeah. But it's definitely...
It's camp.
It's very campy. It's, there's definitely moments that are very silly. The costumes, the creatures kind of silly, which we
when
can talk about.
When you do have the reveal of the creatures... We'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah.
So I think this is the big one. I think the boat one we're both... We really need to get into some time. Even though it's supposed to be the big four questions are at the end. Looks like we're probably going to spend a good amount of time talking about... What about the social political distance? Because that's where there is so much to unpack with this film.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing is the elephant in the room is... That the humanoid creatures attack women. Assault women. Impregnate women.
Yeah.
Which... makes this film difficult, I think.
It
to
makes
rewatch
it difficult.
In 2022.
So I, you know, we've been, it's spooky season right now, so we've been watching a lot of docuseries about horror films.
Yeah.
So A, like the first thing that kind of caught me was the female scientist, Dr. Drake, who is the one leading the research around this kind of mutating the salmon so they grow faster, is a woman, right? Wow, like, so in 1980, you're having a woman as the lead scientist. But the way the cannery owner, the company owner, CEO, introduces her is, like, this nice little lady, which, like, totally diminishes who she is as
who
a person
she is.
By introducing her as this, like, nice little lady or something. It's some phrase that
yeah, and at one
like
point
that.
They're out doing field work trying to figure out what happened. And
she's
you seem pretty certain... And she says to look around you guys, I have to be.
Exactly.
Which is a great shots fired. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And even the scene where she's arguing with another scientist because he's like dismissing the whole situation and she kind of takes him down. So it's kind of that's that there's like a degree of feminism there. Right. Because it is a female doctor. She obviously is intelligent enough to become
mm-hmm.
a lead person in her field and what she's doing. She's doing research at the time that was like very new, right? Thinking about DNA and mutation and things like that. So that was kind of interesting.
Biotech in general, yeah.
Biotech in general. So that was kind of an interesting character. So you have this one side of the film where she is this really intelligent woman who is obviously having to fight sexism to a degree. The one scene that kind of really bothered me was, like, when she was in the swimsuit while they were, like hunting for the creature.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why would she be in a swimsuit?
Because it's a Roger Corman movie.
And then, actually, the kind of hero of the film, his wife actually fights off the monsters. Like, it's a great
she takes care of
by herself. She doesn't need his help. And she actually takes down, like, two monsters herself.
Yes.
Pretty cool. Like, she's a really, really strong... But on the other side, you have these horrific rapes.
Yes, I mean, there's even a scene in the big massacre, you know, the big attack that happens at the town fair, where someone is there in a bikini, and the monster goes to attack her, and the bikini top, of course, gets ripped off, and she runs out of frame towards the camera to get away.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, obviously that shot, it's strange because the... You know, it's one thing that those movies of that era would have, and there is a shower scene,
mm-hmm.
because of course there has to be a shower scene, and there's a scene where they're making out and they get attacked. But there are also those scenes where it seems like actually the sexual assault are to get boobs on the screen.
Right.
Which is very strange.
Yeah, I will say though, like the bikini, the salmon queen that you're referring to.
Yes.
She actually kills the monster. Like she actually
kill the monster.
So she literally does have some degree of agency. She takes the rock and she beats the crap out of that monster and kills the monster. So the thing that's interesting about this though, that and is that none of the women are being punished, right? Like, so a typical thing in a slasher film is you have to be punished for being sexually active, right? So you think about Halloween, you think about Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who die are the ones who are caught having sex in the moment.
Yes, or skinny dipping or whatever, expressing themselves in that way.
But not all of the situations are that, right? So like the last one where we see the wife and mother kill the two, she's just taking care of her baby. She's just, you know.
Yeah.
And I guess she didn't want to do the shower scene, so they got her a body double. But that is like, she's being a good mom, taking care of her baby, and attacked, right? And like, oh, wait, that's not supposed to happen, right? She's a good person. So that part is kind of interesting in the sense of like, as with women being attacked in general, sometimes there's no reason for a woman to be attacked, right? And that's kind of what this film shows. There's no reason. And it kind of takes away that reason of like, but you're slutty, you asked for it.
So you wore that skirt.
You wore that skirt, you deserved it. And it actually takes that narrative away. Because they none of the, like, if you believe, which is a fucked up concept to believe, but if you believe that concept, that film, in this film, that's not even a plausible concept, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting to me in a weird
way. Yeah.
I agree with you. It's ooky that the way
it is ooky. It is ooky, but.
Yeah.
It's strange how this film is complicated.
It's a very complicated film.
I think the other part of the social political distance, again, this subplot of the cannery and this idea that there are. Which is, I think, set the tone for the 80s. It is almost sort of visionary, you know, for the Reagan Revolution that hadn't happened yet. But maybe people had their finger on the pulse of where the country was headed. That, you know, yeah, we can all, in the day after that Musk guy makes the bad cars, bought Twitter, that, you know, people could just kind of, capital can just come in and swoop up and change your neighborhood, prosperity, chances of survival, like that.
Yeah.
And in this case, also capital comes in and unleashes the humanoids from the deep, right? Because they eat the salmon, because we're messing with nature, because we've overfished. There is less fish. Everybody's got to struggle, but then we're going to make super salmon that are just going to be everywhere, and we'll all eat them and become humanoids or something. I don't know. But so there is that anxiety, which, of course, now we live in the era of organic food, which is also weirdly prophetic.
Yeah.
Right? Non-GMO. You go to the co-op and all the food says non-GMO.
Yeah.
You know? Worry about that as well. And also, let's face it, as we do have ecological horror and are living through ecological horror because of global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you think about that, like, in the 70s and 80s, big business was viewed as, like, the hero coming in and bringing in...
Politically. Socially,
no.
Other things were happening.
Well, you know, like, let's give the Walmart, right? Like, how many small-town stores did Walmart destroy when they came into a town, right?
Yes.
And because they're so big and massive, they could have lower prices because they can easily distribute across the country.
And now we have the bulk, retail apocalypse
and
with...
And bulk import, yeah.
Yeah, with Amazon that can actually do it cheaper than Walmart, and you don't have to leave your house, and so then everywhere is getting a Dollar General because you still need some kind of store somewhere. But yeah, I mean, all of that, I think also deindustrialization, you know, there's this whole also subplot with the Vic Morrow character of these guys who are fishermen who, you know, made money with their bodies and the strength of their bodies, but then you also have the female scientist who's really smart and the way that let's face it, a lot of the political backlash that's happening right now is men who used to be able to make really good livings with their bodies being very angry at smart women.
Right.
And true. So that tension is also in the film.
Right, absolutely.
For a film where the creatures are obviously men in rubber suits.
And the thing about it is, like, you know, living in Pennsylvania, especially in Western Pennsylvania, it's beautiful, but you can easily see the impact of steel and coal mining. Yeah. You can drive through a beautiful countryside and around the bend is a slag heap, right?
Yeah.
That is a reality. And, you know, especially with us being in college in that area in the 90s, like, you could still see...
Yeah, the ruins of industrialization.
You would see, like,
still everywhere.
We would see orange water all the time. Or
yeah,
green.
I mean, and there are still dead streams in Western Pennsylvania. Yeah.
So the fascinating thing about this is it's like the cannery hasn't even officially opened and you're already seeing the impact of their efforts. And so typically you don't always get to see the wasteland that results after the cannery starts or after the cannery leaves. But you already get the hit, like, if you do this, it's going to get even worse than the humanoids, right? So that's also the other thing is it's like, the humanoids predated the factory. What happens when they open the factory or if they open the factory?
Yes.
Which is a crazy thought, and the other devastation that would happen after the factory opens. And then if people are eating, if this happened to fish eating
salmon,
what's it going to mean for humans?
When they eat the salmon. And also you have the legacy of settler colonialism.
Absolutely.
Because you have a Native American population that has rights to land and places that they want to be. And ideas of what land should be used for.
Right.
And then you have, these working class people and big business capital who are trying to align or at least have to kind of suckle at the teat at capital, who have very different ideas of what you do with the land and what you do with the people. And so there's also this incredible, and it gets expressed as this incredible, you know, racism. And again, the one guy's dog gets killed as a revenge killing because they think the Native Americans killed the dogs.
Yeah.
So they kill that guy's dog.
And they say some messed up things about him too. Like,
yes, they do.
Racism is very apparent in the interactions. So the hero of the film, who's played by not Troy McClure, but Doug McClure, Jim Hill and his brother are friends with Johnny Eagle, which that's like the worst name ever, Johnny Eagle.
Yes, they had to pick something out of Central Casting. Native American name, Eagle.
So, they're friends with Johnny Eagle. They actually defend him in a fight and try to help him out. So which is interesting, you know, that they're kind of also these town members who are able to still, like, have positive... Live with other humans. I don't think... I don't think he's a... I think he does, like, the touring fishing rather than that. But, so that's kind of interesting because you do have this character who is trying to live in, like, peace with his... with the Native Americans and with others and with fishing, who comes out to be our big hero of the film. So the interesting thing is about Barbara Peters, who is the director. So she leaves the big business of Hollywood and goes into a much more smaller market doing TV, doing Remington Steele, which I don't know if you remember Remington Steele at all.
No.
But the premise of Remington Steele is that the main lead is a woman, PI. Her father was a PI. She was a PI. She hires Pierce Brosnan to be the front for her detective agency because no one takes her seriously as a woman.
Mm.
And so it's kind of interesting that she kind of left this more corporate world and actually was heavily involved with this series that really deals with sexism in a very interesting way.
Question three, which that was a long answer to question two, so we hit it. Section three, the technical distance.
Those monsters are a little...
They're guys in suits. I mean, it's very reminiscent of mid-aught sci-fi channel creature movies, where, again, it's just obviously a guy in a suit. It seems like they had an escalating or varying budget. Some of the creatures do look a little better than the others.
Yeah.
There's some interesting practical effects. When that guy got his face ripped off, that looked
pretty
good.
That was a good one, yeah. That was a pretty good one.
The, you know, of course, the blood bubbling up from the sea when the little boy gets killed looks just straight out of Jaws. Looks great still. But yeah, even on Laserdisc.
Some of those creatures, the final fight scene, it was like really hard to feel like you're supposed to feel tense for this woman. And she's a mother, she's a wife, and she's going to survive. And literally a couple of the monsters look like they have like just dowels that they're holding to make them have longer arms.
Yes.
What it looks like.
Yes.
And I'm just like, huh.
Yeah.
I'm looking at that like, huh, that looks like. I think that's dowels.
Yes, and those suits are obviously very cumbersome, so they don't move naturally.
Right.
Or for things that could, like, kill people and fight people and kill people quite easily, they don't move rather quickly either, or they're strong or whatever, and they can tear you open, but they also don't move very well.
No. No, so, not at all.
So that's part of it.
Now, it is set in the 70s, right? So you're expecting...
Well, it's 79.
79. Well, filming would have been mid-late 70s, right? So, like, you're expecting to see...
Came out in 80.
You're expecting to see telephones. You're expecting... So you, of course, aren't going to see cell phones because of...
Yeah, which is fine. I mean, you know what period... There's a Subaru Brat if you're a car person.
Right, you don't
see... The scientist drives a Subaru Brat, which is pretty awesome.
And pretty rare. You don't see a lot
of those. You don't see a lot of... I don't know if I've ever seen one in the wild this anymore. But Subaru Brat, pretty cool. So, will we ever watch it again?
I'll probably watch the Joe Bob.
Yes, because of Joe Bob Briggs, we will watch it again. There was an episode of Joe Bob Briggs, which we did not watch because we've thought about doing Humanoids from the Deep for quite some time.
Yeah, and we finally got around to doing it.
And then we had to watch the last 2 minutes through Joe Bob Briggs' live stream on Shudder.
Yeah.
Because...
Our laser disc.
There was a scratch on our laser disc, and, you know.
After that, after watching it through Joe Bob and hearing his commentary and his, like, kind of, he does such a great job of, and he interviews Roger Corman.
And he interviews Roger Corman at length.
He also does a great job with just film history.
Yeah.
I'll watch it because of Joe Bob. After that, probably not.
Probably not.
But, yeah. I think it's like, you can see a glimmer of these kind of interesting concepts and elements, but just at the core of it, getting nudie, getting boobs in by rape is just ooky. And so it's not necessarily a film that I'll want to revisit.
Yeah.
Again.
Same.
Yeah.
Same.
All right.
I think that's it.
Yeah. I think that's what we got to say.
We've said what we said. Weirdly complex, not necessarily good.
Yeah.
Icky. It's Roger Corman, though.
What more can you expect? Right?
Exactly.
Exactly. Well, thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.